So let's go on with what we're going to do today. So today is class number 2, and our focus is going to be on refuge. We're going to go over the refuges and what a refuge is, and then the precepts, the 5 precepts, because the refuges and precepts are a really, really important part of Buddhism. And I think a refuge is really important. And we're going to talk about wholesome refuges and unwholesome refuges. And the reason why a refuge is really important is because life can be really hard. It can be a struggle. You know, there are times when we're beset by so much stimulation and so many choices, and we have all this stuff to do to keep life going, and then we have all these needs and desires, and it can be really rather challenging. And especially there are times when difficult emotions like loneliness will arise, or fear will get really scared, or irrational anxiety or emotions might arise. And so there's a part of us that's constantly seeking, especially when we're feeling disjointed like that, that's seeking some stability, some ground that we can stand on, something that'll help appease whatever difficult emotions we're feeling. And this is considered a refuge. You know, it helps calm us down, make us feel safer, nurtured, supported. Yeah. So as a young adult, the Buddha saw clearly how he had been taking refuge in a lot of false refuges. As you may remember, he was raised as a prince in a rich palace. He had 3 palaces, actually, his father. And they lavished him with women. He had all the women he could possibly have. He had entertainers, lavish food, you name it. He was taking part in all these different false refuges. And they weren't bringing him lasting happiness. See, he saw, oh my gosh, I have everything any human being could possibly want. I'm still not happy. So he left his palace and he went out to seek a true refuge, a lasting refuge. That's what he was looking for. And what he ended up finding was the truth as his refuge. The truth as in how things really are, how the universe operates. And to him, the truth was the ultimate refuge one could have. And knowing the truth will be the refuge, will bring a freedom and peace and joy, right? So in traditional Buddhist religions, the very first step to becoming a Buddhist, if you ever decide to become a Buddhist, is to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And that's what I'm going to be talking about. And then after you do that, you take the 5 precepts. So there's a ritual thing. We've never done any of these rituals here, but I'm offered to do them if anybody really wants to. So when I first started going on Buddhist meditation retreats, we always took the refuges and the precepts. In fact, now that I lead retreats, we take the refuges and the precepts on retreat. And I had resistance. I had resistance to it.
What do you mean you took it on Wednesday?
Yeah, well, you'll see. Oh. There's a chanting that you do in order to take the refuges and the precepts. In fact, we're going to do it today. But it's, you know, a ritual where you're repeating these statements. But I had a lot of resistance to it. I didn't quite understand it.
You think it's because it's too much, too ritual?
Yeah, I had a lot of resistance to ritual and rites anyhow, but I didn't quite understand it. I had faith in my ability to meditate, but I didn't have faith in the teachers. I didn't have faith in Buddhism. I didn't have faith in anything else, just my own ability to meditate. And I didn't come for all the trappings. You know, so I had somewhat of a bad attitude towards Buddhism and the Buddhist teachings when I first started. But back in the Buddha's time, in the 5th century BC, there were literally hundreds of different spiritual traditions around that area. And a person could plug into any one of the spiritual traditions. Most of them came out of the Hindi tradition, you know, the yogic tradition. But a lot of people were very spiritual in that time. They were like Asheville. But there were, in that time, in that area, that most everybody was a spiritual follower of somebody or some one of these hundreds of religions. So it's a very spiritual time. But in order to become a follower of one of these traditions, you had to take, the tradition was to take refuge in that tradition. And each one had their own ritual in order to take refuge. In the classic texts, the Buddhist texts, the way that someone took refuge with the Buddha, that was to become, in that time, a renunciate, a monastic nun, or female or male, they had to go to the Buddha and they would say these words. Master Gotama, that was his name, has made the Dharma clear in so many ways, as though he was turning upright what had been thrown upside down, revealing what has been hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the darkness. So I now go for refuge to Master Gotama. Or may I go to, or they would ask, may I go to refuge with you, Master Gotama? And he would either say yes or no. So let's talk about what is a refuge. A refuge is a person, place, thing, or idea. It could even be a concept that gives us protection from harm or danger, or has us feel safe, right? Yeah. But what danger are we needing protection from?
The world.
The world, right? Could be anything. Oftentimes it's our own mind. what's happening right here, but... Without an untrained mind, when we start training our mind, we start seeing some of our, you know, issues or these karmic conditions coming up, right? But with a trained mind, an untrained mind, the dangers to us are not evident to us. They're not obvious. So they're subtle, they're camouflage. They're deflected. We're constantly projecting them onto everyone else and fearing the world at large and making up entire stories about this group of people or that group of people. Or we could go on and on about how we all do this to a certain degree, right? In Buddhism, that's called ignorance or delusion. When we do this deflecting and projecting and making others wrong, bad. But there's a lot of danger. There is a lot of danger in the world. And because of that, untrained minds tend to take refuge in false sense of securities or false refuges. And we all have. And we all probably still do to some degree. But the thing is, it's not necessarily to stop taking refuge in false things, which you eventually will if your practice as it strengthens, but to at least be aware of when you're taking refuge in something that's false. The thing that Buddha taught was that taking refuge in anything in the conditioned realm is a false refuge. Because everything in the conditioned realm is temporary. It's fleeting, it's changing. There's nothing solid that you can count on in this world. You know, look at people in Sonoma, California, who took refuge in their homes that are gone now, or in Puerto Rico, taking refuge in a partner that just suddenly dies, right? So what we learn in Buddhism is that there is no true refuge in the conditioned realm. And so we start to see how we create false refuges with things in the conditioned realm.
Is that isn't that when it's not to be attached, non-attachment?
It's part of it, yeah. It's part
to,
of it.
Whatever you just mentioned, just things.
Anything in the conditioned realm.
Conditioned.
Yeah, to stop assigning power to things, people, and places that they don't have, right? And to see that clearly. So when as my practice deepened, I realized that the only true refuge I had was the truth of what's actually happening in this moment. Experiential truth, my heart, the love that I have for the world and for others, and connecting to a place that was resonating deep within me, that's always there, consistently there, that it's not in this external world, it's in this internal realm. But I had to do really deep practice to start tapping into this internal realm and being able to take refuge in it. And I believe that's what the Buddha was pointing to with the refuges. I learned that taking refuge was not about blind faith, not about following some Buddhist religion or being saved by the Buddha, but to touching in those kernels of us within me, of wisdom, of love, compassion, caring, connection. You know, you guys intuitively know what I'm talking about, right? Yeah.
To be mindful of those little gems.
Exactly.
Think about it.
Yeah. And to be able, when I find myself, I use this cartoon character a lot of the coyote and Roadrunner, mm-hmm. who goes off the cliff.
Yeah.
And for a minute, his little legs are going like this, and his eyes get really big, and he looks down, and he realizes for a second, I'm about to take a dive. So that's what happens to us, honestly. Right before we go running to the chocolate or to whatever false refuge we're going to bring comfort, we have this moment of sheer panic, like discomfort. Not always as panicked as the coyote, but... this is like...
might not be life and death.
Yeah. So, Buddhism, we're going to talk more about this next week. I believe it's next week. But it's based on suffering, the truth of suffering, dukkha. That's what suffering is called. And the truth of dukkha is that birth is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering, getting sick is suffering, getting what you don't want is suffering, not getting what you do want is suffering. So that's the basic truth that the Buddha taught, that we need to understand when we're suffering.
So back to your house.
Yes.
You may have refuge in your house, but the suffering comes when you keep thinking about another house that's better that you wish you had. You spend all this time like not appreciating what you have.
That's a great example.
And then suffer from the wanting of the other.
Exactly.
And then when you get that, you continue to want. I mean, it just is a cycle that's unwinnable.
Yeah, the constant wanting.
So what silly suffering that is.
Yeah, not seeing it. That's the hardest thing.
And not seeing, yeah. When you see it, you can change it.
Exactly, hopefully. And the wanting mind is a really strong habit. The craving, wanting mind is incredibly strong. And even if you decide, okay, I'm happy with this 10th house now, then the mind will start wanting other things. Craving, desiring other things, and taking refuge in other things. So what are some of the false refuges that human beings take refuge in?
Well, I would say a lot of sex.
A lot of sex, pleasurable, hopefully sex.
Clothes, possessions.
Possessions, like, clothes, shopping.
Stuff, shopping.
I used to take refuge in shopping. Whenever I got really stressed out, right. I would go shopping.
I've done that, like, oh, I feel a little bored or lonely. Shop and buy okay. something, cheer you up, but it's only less.
Yeah, when you're lonely, maybe shop. What else?
You probably haven't paid for it yet, and it's that feeling's gone, right? It's on credit card.
Yeah, you feel the... Huh?
Entertainments.
Entertainments, okay.
I went out and bought an Xbox. When I first moved into my house, I had never played a video game in my life, but I immersed myself, because I could be mindless with that.
Mm-hmm. Xbox, okay, entertainment.
Drugs,
alcohol, mm-hmm. food.
Oh, absolutely.
Food.
Television.
Being busy. Social media. I've been.
Busy, social media. Right?
Exercise even, and things that are not necessarily bad for you, but still.
Yeah, so that's more of a, hopefully wholesome, more of a wholesome refuge. There is, leveling and wholesome and unwholesome, but when we get attached to it, like I'm going to die if I don't get to exercise today, then it's gone over into the unwholesome. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we could go on and on and on. I have a good friend who's got some mental health problems, and we used to walk together 3-4 days a week in the morning, and she's had a downturn with her medication, and but this isn't the first time it's happened. It's like the third or fourth time, and before I used to be like, what am I going to walk with? What am I going to do? And I would get a little anxious, and each time I realized, oh, I was getting really attached, and now she's been gone for about 4 weeks now, and I'm just like, oh, I'll walk by myself today. But I was definitely taking refuge in her and our friendship and the walking. So I got to see that. And
seems very touchy.
Hmm?
Seems very touchy. It could be wholesome or not wholesome.
Yeah.
Seems like walking with your friend would be.
Yeah, walking thing. With. I miss her.
What made it not wholesome was because when she wasn't there to do it, then you were missing it too much.
Right, and I realized.
Without thinking.
I realized that I was taking refuge in a false refuge. Because she's not going to always be there for me. She could die tomorrow. She could have another mental breakdown. Something could happen. Right? And so, it's not her fault. It's not like she's choosing to opt out. She can't help it. So that was not skillful for me to be taking refuge in that. Right? And so, once again, seeking anything outside of myself instead of what's happening right inside here causes me a lot of dukkha, a lot of stress, right? Anyhow, so here's a quote. What does it mean to take refuge? And I don't remember which teacher this is from. It might even be from the Buddha. I don't have it written down. But just as a traveler caught in a storm will seek shelter, and a Vipassana practitioner, that's a meditator, will look for a way to end stress in his or her life. If the traveler is able to find shelter inside a building that is strong and safe, he will call out to others who are still struggling in the storm outdoors to join him or her in this safe refuge. Similarly, when a person understands how this practice brings peace, clarity, and a way to end suffering, out of compassion, one will also encourage others to take the same refuge. I've learned that hasn't been very helpful either with my family members. So the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha are called the triple gem or three jewels because they represent a path which is precious like a gem. You can take refuge in the Buddha, you can take refuge in the Dharma, you can take refuge in the Sangha. And we'll talk a little bit about each one, why they're deep, powerful refuges. So the word Buddha is a title given to those who have attained final enlightenment. There are four stages of enlightenment, and the Buddha didn't call himself the Buddha. Other people called him the Buddha, and that was the term that they used for people who had reached final enlightenment. Fully awakened, fully enlightened one. After he reached enlightenment, he taught for 40 plus years. And when he died at 80 years old, he reached enlightenment, I think, at 39 years old, and then he taught until he was 80 and a half or something, then he died. So his followers were people who recognized that he was free, that he was free from the suffering that other people are bound to, the human desire, wanting, craving, having to have, the ill will, anger, frustration, and the ignorance and delusion that everyone else has, that motivate, all these things motivate us to do some unskillful, unwholesome actions, right? So he was considered the teacher of compassion. He was a very excellent teacher. And he had thousands and thousands of followers by the time he died. He had several monasteries. I think there were like 7 or 9 of them. Well, there were a lot of big monasteries with hundreds of monks and nuns at each one. Plus a lot of his ones that became enlightened under him went and started their own. So it was really huge by the time he died in 40 years. So when you take refuge in the Buddha, you're acknowledging that because he awakened, that we can awaken too. Does that make sense? So when we take refuge in the Buddha, we're taking refuge in appreciation for him, for seeking the path, finding the answers, you know, awakening, and then teaching for 40 years. So there's appreciation. We can send appreciation to him, or we can send, I take refuge in the Buddha. Well, but it's mainly taking refuge in our own seeds of enlightenment within ourselves. We're all capable of awakening. Every human being is. So that's what it means when we're taking refuge in our own potential to awaken from our dream state, from our suffering states. When we're taking refuge in the Buddha, we're also taking refuge in all the thousands of people who've done this practice over the thousands of years, who've awakened to certain levels, either fully awakened or partially, who've experienced more freedom because of this practice, more joy, more peace. So we can connect to the whole energy of everyone who's ever done this practice. Anyone have any questions or comments about taking refuge in the Buddha? Okay. So the second refuge we can take refuge in is the Dharma. So I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma. The Dharma, these are considered this path, any path, any path. The Dharma, the word stands for its path to awakening, path to freedom. It's also considered the truth. Dharma is considered the truth. It's considered a teaching. It's considered instruction. Anything that leads us towards more freedom, joy, and peace is considered that path. Those instructions are considered the Dharma. So it doesn't necessarily have to be this particular tradition. Any wisdom tradition that leads to more freedom is considered a Dharma. Right? So at its deepest level, the Dharma in this practice, and I think I've mentioned this already, helps us learn about the true nature of reality, the true nature of life. And we do it in two particular ways. This path has two particular ways we'll be talking about a lot. The first is sila, which is to purify our conduct. And the second one is bhavana, mental development. And that's why we meditate, that's why we do mindful awareness practices, to be aware of what's arising within us, right? This teaching of the Buddha is contained in three primary collections of Buddhist teachings. Or they're called scriptures. Some people call them scriptures. And they're the three baskets, the Tripitaka in Pali. And they consider the three of them are the Sutta Pitakas, which are the discourses. Most of them are from the Buddha himself. Some of them are from his primary students that we're teaching as well. The second one is the basket of the Vinaya Pitaka, which are the rules, disciplines governing the monastic tradition. Men have 227 rules, the monastic men, and the women had 300 and some.
And,
yeah, I don't know why. I've made up a lot of things based on my own biases. But and the third one is the Abhidhamma Pitaka, which is Buddhist psychology and the philosophies behind Buddhism. Okay, so those are the three primary baskets. The Buddhists learn in two primary ways. One is through intellectual learning and instruction, taking it in intellectually, and the other is from practicing. The Buddha had his students do both. So he would give talks to them, and he would ask them to memorize different talks. So they did a lot of chanting in order to memorize things. And then they also did a lot of meditation, a lot of meditation. But anyhow, there is when you're learning from someone who's done this practice for a while, there's considered an energetic transference of intellectual knowing as well. Because when you're with someone who's done this practice for a long time, you can feel inspired, moved. There's if you notice compassion or wisdom, then it ignites the compassion and wisdom within you. So there's a definite energetic transference. When I've been on retreats a lot, I would be sitting and waiting in the meditation hall, and I would know as soon as the primary teacher walked into the room, I could feel like electrical, my whole body lighting up. You know, I'm talking about retreats with 100 or more people on it, and then I'd be like, open my eyes, and sure enough, one of the primary teachers are walking in. So I don't know if you believe in all that energetic stuff, but I definitely do because I felt it. The more you learn and practice, the more confidence and faith you have in the Dharma. It's really important to practice and to learn. I think that in America, there's definitely an imbalance with the learning and the practicing. Which one do you think we tend to be dominant on? The learning, right? So people have read like 20 books before they ever come to their first meditation session. It's not unusual. And I think their society promotes that, don't you think? Yeah, intellectual prowess. Yeah. I mean, look who's held with highest esteem in our society. PhDs, lawyers.
Doctors.
Right? The Buddha taught that you need to balance these two, the experiential and the intellectual. So that's the way he taught. I started this practice with all experiential before I started ever learning the Dharma because I had so much resistance to it. So I think I had been practicing 15 years before I started learning anything, becoming interested in learning about it. So I come from the experiential is much more important than the intellectual because that's the path I took. But also, what was interesting for me is because I've been practicing for so long that when I started learning the intellectual, I was like, oh, okay, I get this, because I had the experience already. But the Buddha taught both ways because let's say you have an experience, but you don't know how to contextualize it. So the intellectual knowledge will help you contextualize your experience so that you don't mentally proliferate and chew on it forever, going, I wonder what that was. I wonder what this is. I wonder, you know, what. So if you're like, oh, yeah, okay, this is expected, this is normal, or, yeah. Any questions about the Dharma? Okay. The wisdom teachings, taking refuge in these teachings. And also that so many thousands of people have awakened using these teachings. So I think it's really powerful. All right, the third one is taking refuge in the Sangha. The Sangha was originally the group of students who reached enlightenment, awakening. So everybody were students, but as soon as you awakened, then you got to be part of the Sangha. And then if you were fully awakened, you could teach then. So you would go to a Sangha member and learn from one of them. That was the way the Buddha originally. The community of noble ones, they were called. They were a truly example of people who led exemplary lives because they renunciated the world and devoted their life to completely awakening. So their achievements were an example for everyone to follow. People looked up to Sangha members. They got faith from the Sangha members. They got support from them. They got wisdom from them, right? So that's how it was originally. Today, the Sangha is considered a structure for the same thing, structure for support, wisdom, and community is why people come and join the Sangha. Have you guys had experience of support with the Sangha? And yet, or strength in community?
I meditated in a place in Dover, New Hampshire. And it definitely felt like it was a Sangha. I mean, the public was invited to come in, but it was clear that there were many people there that come a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I would guess that was what that was.
Mm-hmm.
It's been so many years, it maybe even had a name that indicated that, I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But I would consider that a Sangha.
Nice.
And a whole community of, and they had the events, and they had people coming and speaking, and ongoing meditation times.
Okay.
Would that be?
Yeah, that's definitely a Sangha. But you really have to plug in and come regularly to get to know people and feel the support, the energy of the collective.
Didn't happen in my case because it was too far away.
Okay. Yeah. You've been coming some. Have you experienced any Sangha?
Well, especially at the retreat.
Yeah.
But yes,
yeah.
I can feel it when I walk in sometimes.
Yeah. It's pretty palpable once you start plugging into a Sangha, create relationships, when you meditate. So when we meditate here versus meditating at home, it's totally different. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Have you experienced it? Meditation usually goes quicker, seems to be more energy, less apt to fall asleep, or more relaxed if you're typically anxious. So there's an energetic feel of a group that is so supportive, really very supportive. Yeah. But being around other people who have long-term practices is considered powerful. In other words, if you meditate with someone who has a long-term practice, then that'll help speed up your own wisdom and your own practice. All right, that's why people come on retreats, because they want to be with someone who's has been doing this practice for a long time, and also to gain the wisdom from them, the intellectual and the experiential knowing. It's really important, and then you feel the community of people energetically. It's powerful, really powerful. It's like going to a gym and you suddenly everybody's working out and you're like, oh yeah, I'm going to plug into this, and then next thing you know, you're working out or swimming if you go to the pool or whatever you do. It feels like we're all doing the same thing together. So it gives you faith and support and energy. It's a wonderful thing. There are a lot of different sanghas in Buddhism. There's some sanghas, I think we talked about last time, where they're considered Tibetan. They consider the primary teacher as like a guru. And they have, did we talk about this last time? The guru model, where they pay homage to the main teacher and they treat the main teacher like there's some kind of a...
like worshiping more.
Yeah, in our tradition in Theravada, we pay respects to our teacher. It's considered an honor to buy the teacher a meal or to clean their dishes or to open a door for them or to help pay their bills or give money, generosity. It's considered an honor. But in other lineages, they treat them like they're some kind of a god. They'll do anything that they say. It's different than our tradition. Our tradition, we don't go beyond respect. Does that make any sense? Yeah. So the teacher doesn't act like they're some greater otherworldly being than somebody else. In the Theravadan tradition, they're considered more human, less godlike. Good, because I'm definitely not godlike. What's really great about plugging into the system is we want to plug in with people where we have common aspirations and common values, similar belief systems. And most people that come to a Buddhist-type group, mindfulness group, what do you think are some of their values and aspirations?
They're less into acquisition, maybe.
More simplistic life, perhaps?
And they're seekers. I mean, that's a big thing, but they are looking beyond themselves and, trying to find truth.
Okay, seekers of truth.
Yeah.
Community.
Okay.
Of other like-minded people to reinforce what I'm experiencing.
Nice. Yeah, you think most people that come to a meditation group are interested in being nice people, good people? Self-aware, maybe, a little bit. You don't have to worry about your pocketbook getting stolen.
Honesty.
Usually, right? So we have a lot of common values, and most people are wanting to improve themselves in some way. If not self-improve, at least awaken to their true, beautiful Buddha nature. Yeah. So let's talk about taking refuge. These are the taking refuge. Thank you. So this is when I became a nun, I had to do this. And we do it on retreats. And we start out by paying homage to the Buddha 3 times. It's homage to him, the blessed one, the worthy one, the fully enlightened one. And then we take refuge. They had this thing in time of Buddha about the number 3. They believed in the power of numerology. There's some magical power about saying something 3 times made it so much more powerful. So they take refuge in the Buddha then they take ref for the second, then they do it for the second time, and then for the third time. Same with Dhamma and Sangha. All right. So I'll just do it. You're welcome to do it with me or just listen. Either way, I'm just going to do. And then you guys can say, if you want to, the English. Okay. I'm going to. Do you want me to do the Namo Tassa? Okay.
And then we repeat it maybe in English. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the first, I'll just do it, and then we'll repeat it. I'm going to do Namo Tassa three times, and then in English once. Okay. And I'll let you know what we're doing. So, it's Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambodasa. You're welcome to join me if you like. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Then in English, homage to him, the blessed one, the worthy one, the fully enlightened one. We're not going to say it three times. Okay. Bodham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dhamma. I take refuge in the Sangha. Dutiyampi bodham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. For the second time, I take refuge in the Buddha. For the second time, I take refuge in the Dhamma. For the second time, I take refuge in the Sangha. Tatiyampi bodham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. For the third time, I take refuge in the Buddha. For the third time, I take refuge in the Dhamma. For the third time, I take refuge in the Sangha. All right. So when I bow on retreats, and sometimes when I come in here, I bow three times to the Buddha. And when I bow, this is how I learned as a nun, you know, you hold your hands in your heart. And the first time I bow to the Buddha, the refuge of taking refuge in the Buddha. You don't have to do any of this. The second time I bow, I take refuge in the Dhamma. The third time I bow, I take refuge in the Sangha. And I look at the Buddha before I do anything, and I thank this wonderful path and this practice that's brought me so much peace and joy and connection with others and forgiveness and allowing and letting go. And, so I feel all these things as I'm bowing, the gratitude and appreciation. And it also gives me a little bit more energy and courage to continue when the going gets rough. All right? So that's what taking refuge is all about. And these are considered three wholesome refuges instead of unwholesome refuges. Any questions about taking refuge? All right, well, let's take a 5-minute refuge break.